I'm Terry Teachout, drama critic of the Wall Street Journal.
I'm Elizabeth Vincentelli. I write for the New York Times, the New Yorker, and the Village Voice.
And I'm Peter Marks, theater critic of the Washington Post. We are bringing you episode 15 of Three on the Isle, a podcast from New York about theater in America. We're hosted by American Theater Magazine, a publication of the Theater Communications Group.
Summertime, but that doesn't mean the theater world rests easy,
if it ever does.
Right.
On this episode, we're going to talk about an incident that I was witness to in St. Louis earlier this month. It was a protest that erupted at the Muni, the city's sprawling outdoor theater, during a performance of all things, a revival of the anthology musical Jerome Robbins Broadway.
So you may already have read about the incident. What happened is that theater professionals who were attending a conference in St. Louis stood up during the show to voice their objections to a white actress portraying the character of Tuptim, a Burmese concubine, in a scene from Rodgers and Hammerstein, The King and I. And to clarify, the Jerome Robbins Broadway is a collection of Jerome Robbins' various,
production numbers.
Numbers.
From his various
so this
shows.
Particular one was from The King and I. And the protest crystallized an explosive issue in the theater.
And that issue has come to be described as whitewashing, a form of cultural appropriation in which actors are cast in roles belonging to characters of other ethnicities. There's a history going back decades of actors of color and others speaking out against this practice, and yet we still have it around. We'll talk about the implications of the controversial topic and the increasingly heated debate over it. And we'll be joined in that conversation by Deep Tran, the senior editor at American Theater Magazine. And, of course, we'd love to hear your thoughts about it by tweet or email after you hear ours.
We'll also be talking on this episode to one of our out-of-town colleagues, Lily Janik, the talented theater critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. She's going to bring us up to speed on theater happenings of note on the West Coast.
So we're going to talk to Lily about how she approaches her job, what responsibilities come with being a key opinion leader in one of the nation's great theater cities, and where and how drama in the Bay Area connects with the rest of the country.
The three of us will, as is our critical custom, wrap things up by citing a few of our favorite nights in the theater, and we'll ask Lily to contribute her own recommendations. First, though, a consideration of this deeply emotional issue in the theater world, an issue for which no one seems to have devised a set of guidelines by which everyone plays.
So the issue is how directors and producers cast characters of color and specific ethnicity. In the less enlightened time, white actors were often chosen to play, for example, Asian and Native American characters, quote-unquote whitewashing practices that are now denounced as reinforcing yellow face and red face stereotype.
And yet, we still do see some of these incidents cropping up, and they cause a lot of upset. You can read about voices rising in protest against whitewashing everywhere from high school stages to professional ones. We've asked Deep Tran, who's often in the studio when we tape, to contribute her expertise on the subject. Hey, Deep.
What up?
But Terry, why don't you start us off by telling us what happened mid-performance at the Muni?
Well, first, a little perspective. Jerome Robbins Broadway has never been revived since its original run on Broadway, where it opened in 1989. And that's why I was out there. I couldn't be there for the opening night because I was covering another opening elsewhere in the country. But we sent one of our dance writers, Laura Jacobs, to actually review the show. However, I just wanted to see it because I have a long history with the show. I actually saw the original production, which Robin supervised 6 times, and I was most curious to see what St. Louis would do with it. So I flew out to St. Louis, went to the Muni, which is a very, very large outdoor amphitheater, 12,000, 14,000 seats. I can't remember which.
But 11.
A whole bunch of
11,
a whole bunch of guys.
It's still big.
Yeah. Give or take 3,000.
Yeah. Too big for a theater, perhaps.
Right. So the first half of the show proceeded uneventfully. And then the first thing that happens after intermission is that the show goes into the ballet from The King and I, the Small House of Uncle Thomas, which is a sequence in which a group of the King of Siam's enslaved wives enact a Siamese version of Uncle Tom's Cabin, which is meant to be an anti-slavery ballet, and it's being done in his presence. That's the conceit of it in the show.
That's very well said.
So the show gets off, the ballet gets off to a start, and then fairly quickly, I hear shouting from somewhere behind me. I'm in the eighth row of this monstrously large theater. And I hear noise. I can't hear what anybody's saying. I just hear people shouting. I turned around in my seat, and I couldn't see them either because the place is so big. And then I see people moving, and it's clear to me that they're being hustled out of the theater by the staff. Now, as I say, I didn't hear what they were shouting. As far as I know, they weren't unfurling any banners or anything. But it hit me immediately that this had to be a protest that had something or other to do with the content of The Small House of Uncle Thomas. Now, I hadn't looked at the casting because this was an ensemble show, so I had no idea that the role of Tuptim was being played by a Caucasian actress. And this house is so big, I'm not sure you could tell it even from there.
Well, I was so far back, you couldn't even tell that they're not Asian.
What were they shouting?
A boo yellow face.
Right.
And how many people were shouting?
About 15.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And also, just to give some more context, because it was a theater conference, the Muni offered free tickets to anyone who was going to the conference. And so a number of people came, and they walked out individually, in addition to the 15 protesters.
Really?
Yes.
So the whole thing was over in a minute, no more, mm-hmm. not much more than a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until afterwards that I found out exactly what it was about, because Jeremy Goodman was covering the event for the St. Louis Public Radio's website. And he knew I was in the house because I'd said so on Twitter. He got in touch with me and said, "What did you think?" And told me what it was all about. I mean, up to that moment, I hadn't known precisely what it was about. And I said, "Well, I'm probably going to write about this, so let me reserve my opinion." And then, Deep, you got in touch with me and let me know that you had been in the house as well. So
yeah, and, well, do you want to sum up what you wrote? Because I feel like I don't agree with what you wrote, but I feel like we should talk about it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
My feeling, I mean, I wrote a column for the Journal explaining to the readers what they had seen, explaining to them the concept of yellow face, which is a word that we in the theater community are accustomed to.
Well, entertainment in general,
right.
Actually.
But I think is not so generally known to the public at large, and I'm sure that most of the people in the theater in St. Louis probably had not heard it. So I tried to fill them in on that, and then I basically expressed my opinion, which is that, as far as I'm concerned, you don't interrupt a performance with a protest. I just think that it's inappropriate in all sorts of different ways. It seems to me that it is, as I said in the paper, an act of censorship de facto to try to stop a performance because you disapprove of its content. And I compared it to the last prominent episode we've had of this kind was last summer at another outdoor performance at Shakespeare in the Park, Oscar Eustace's production of Julius Caesar, in which the title character was dressed as Donald Trump, and at which two alt-right protesters, angry at the fact that Donald Trump was assassinated in the course of the production, actually got up. I think they made it to the stage and
I was there.
Right, and attempted to stop the show that way. And it struck me, and this is what I said in the paper, that if you disapprove of one of these things, you really need to be disapproving of the other as well, that the governing principle is separate from the question of, is the protest about something with which you agree, but that this is not a thing that one ought to do at a live performance.
Well, and the way I think about it is, I mean, this is America. This is theater where you're performing in front of a live audience, and you need to be prepared for the volatility of that audience, especially when it is something as upsetting as white actors playing Asian characters. Like there's a long upsetting history of white actors just basically taking the very few opportunities there are for people of color to play themselves on stage, and the one time that community says no, you cannot do that. It is offensive to us, and we have our own. We have enough actors that we can provide for you to play these roles. The fact that that is completely disregarded is something that is worth being upset about. And at the same time, I actually don't think the alt-right supporters last year were in the wrong in protesting. I support their right to protest. I support anyone's right to protest, but I But I disagree with you, Terry, in saying that in making that one-to-one correlation only because the alt-right protesters actually rushed the stage and tried to stop the show. The Muni protesters, they just made their voices heard and then they left when they were told to leave.
I would also say, I would say that there that the equivalency of those two acts is false because the people who did this last summer at Julius Caesar were political actors. They were people who had a mission that was not about art. It was purely about disruption. That was their goal. The goal of the protesters in this situation, from what I'm gleaning, was a kind of outburst not meant to stop the production. At least that's what you're telling me. And also, importantly, it's the sort of welling up of a movement that has not had any, has only had limited impact by just sort of writing essays. This was sort of this is the latest development sort of coming to a head of an issue that has been around since at least Miss Saigon in 1989.
Before, since like the original King and I.
Yeah, right.
The original King and I.
Since there was an Othello.
That the actual politicization of it became a political issue with Miss Saigon and Jonathan Pryce playing the engineer, actually playing it very well and winning a Tony for it. But
I
that
can't watch
said,
him do it, but that's
right,
just me.
Again, understanding, being sensitized to the issue, becoming sensitized, and understanding why that was so horrifying to actors of color, particularly to Asian American actors.
Deep, is horrifying the right word?
I mean, I'm an Asian American person, so me watching it is horrifying because it is. I'm going to speak personally, not as someone who reported on the thing. The act of it's the fact that growing up, I never saw a representation of myself in American entertainment, and so the few opportunities there are to see yourself and a white person's playing it, like that's it's like you already took like all of the food from me, and now you want like the little crumbs that I have left. Like what the hell is wrong with you people? And at the same time, it's like as you were saying, Peter, the issue has been brought up again and again. And just to give some more context about the Muni, like this isn't the first time like a bunch of people have protested at that theater. Like in 2016, Black Lives Matter protested a production of Aida, and people were actually arrested for that one.
Really?
During the performance?
Yeah.
Wow.
But so I think they're not unaccustomed to controversy. But sorry, it's Friday. So what was my train of thought here?
Well, you were talking about why it was horrifying to you, that it was something that had was deeply emotionally affecting.
Well, and the thing is, it's like these things keep on coming up again and again in theater and in the film and in Hollywood as well, of like, you know, they cast Scarlett Johansson as an Asian Ghost in the Shell. We talk about that. Cast Emma Stone, we talk about that. And then they do it in theaters and high schools around the country. We keep talking about it and talking about it and talking about it, and somehow it is still a controversial statement to say people of color should only, like, it's still a controversial statement to say that characters of color should only be played by people of color, not because, you know, only white people can play white people, only straight people can play straight people. It is a very fact that there is a lack of opportunity and a lack of equality on either side. It's always like white people playing people of color. It's very, very rarely, with the exception of Hamilton, the other way around.
One of the kind of examples that we often hear is I'm playing devil's advocate here. Like one of the counter arguments we often hear is, well, but if Joshua Henry can play Billy Bigelow in Carousel, why can't? And I think it's a false equivalency.
Why can't what?
It is.
You know, why can't a white actor played Tup Tim in King and I? There was a production of The King and I in Paris just like 3 years ago where a white actor played the king, like not just Tup Tim, the king.
Well, yours has very problematic racial representations.
You know, it's like something else. But what do you think of that argument?
And it's a false equivalency. White people have played people of color throughout history. And I compare it to affirmative action. Like, you need to create access.
It's the point at which the rest of the world comes into the room for theater, I think. And the context here is that it's not a level playing field in this culture.
No.
And until that happens, until there's a sense that that I think that Black and Asian and Latino people live in a society that in which all the barriers are down the way they have been traditionally for white people, that until that time, we have to be conscious of the opportunities given to people of color to take over
just used the word opportunity, and a lot of what we've been saying here seems to me to couch this issue, so to speak, in economic terms, that scarce resources are being taken away from people who ought to have them. There's another side to that coin, and I have personal knowledge of it because I've written a play in which an actor plays a white person and a Black person. Mm. Now, I didn't specify in the published version of this play that the actor must be Black, but I would not give approval for a production in which he wasn't. I wouldn't even consider it. And for me, I wouldn't see this as a utility question, an economics question. And I wrote a column about this a couple of years ago, and I found it hard to articulate why I wouldn't approve of it. It just seemed self-evident to me that one of the characters is Louis Armstrong and the other one is his Jewish agent. And it seemed self-evident to me that you, maybe a century from now, mm-hmm. it might be appropriate and even interesting to have a white person play that part. Mm-hmm. But it's not now. And I think everybody knows that.
What do we think of the issue that is also recently surfaced about a production of Ethel Fugard, Blood Knot, which the play is about two South African brothers, both Black, but one passes as white. And in a recent production, the lighter skin one was cast with the white actor, as it was in a recent production in New York at Signature just a few years ago.
Right. Let me give some background on this specific production, because I haven't seen it, but this is a company that I've talked about in the show, American Players Theater in Wisconsin. Which has really been, in the last 3 or 4 years especially, making a tremendous attempt to expand and diversify both the shows that it does and the casting of those shows. This production was directed by Ron O.J. Parsons, very prominent Black director. I think he's based in Chicago. Really first-rate artist. And Jim DeVita, who is one of the best actors in America, is playing the light-skinned Black role. And Parsons signed off on this casting. And, of course, so did Ethel Fugard, who has played the role himself in the past. So you've got a different situation. You have one where people involved in the production, including its Black director, are saying, okay, we're doing this for a reason, because this casts particular light on the show. I mean, he would have to give his own reasons for it, but he clearly thought that it was fine with him.
Well, the original production had a white and Black actor on the stage in South Africa, and part of the political dimension of it was the first time a white and a Black actor had been on the stage together in South Africa. So it had a real dramatic effect beyond the question of race.
What this says to me is that some things are obvious. You don't want a Caucasian actress playing Toop Tim. There's no reason for it. It doesn't shed light in the show. I mean, it deprives somebody who ought to have the opportunity. That one's clear cut. But there are other cases, I think, that do have to be judged on the individual merits. And you have to ask yourself, why would you do this? What would you get out of it? How is it advantageous? What is the message that you want to send? I think more often than not, you're going to come up with the same answer, which is that whitewashing casting, it's just not appropriate for a variety of reasons. But at the same time, I think particularly with this production, I'm not sure that a blanket covering rule that says this is never okay anywhere at any time accounts for the realities of this particular production.
It's such a complicated issue. It's so complicated. But actually, in a way, why can't we clarify these things so that we're all on the same page about them? I feel as if it's up to the individual director or theater to make these calls, and it's confusing after a while to have to worry about whether it's cultural or in the region in which this thing happens. You know, is it different in St. Louis than it is in New York?
But there are rules. The rules are white people should not be playing people of color. That is the rule. No one wants to listen to it and acknowledge that that is a rule, but that is the rule.
Okay, so what would you do about that blood knot?
With no possible exception, ever.
What about blood knot? What do you think of that?
I'm asking not the question of whether it is a rule. Why is that not so clear?
Because Actors Equity says that you need to open up auditions to everyone regardless of the race of the character. So everyone can come audition, but that doesn't mean that everyone should be able to play the role.
Yes, they have to say that.
They could be sued if they did.
Yeah, they had to do that for Hamilton, notoriously. If you remember, I think the first casting call for the tour, I think it was, for Hamilton said...
No white people,
and that didn't go over well.
Yeah, it's not actually legal for you to say white people, but it is legal for you to say this character is this race.
Wouldn't stand up to a court challenge if somebody wanted to go after the saying that in reality we're not going to cast anybody who's not of that race.
Do we want playwrights of color to help us understand this? I mean, there's a play in New York right now called Fairview by Jackie Sibley's Drury, which addresses some of this in a really fascinating way. I think, Elizabeth, you had strong feelings about this.
Yeah, I love the show, and I think she deals with two things that we talked about a little bit. One is the idea of disruption of the live performance, because the play ends with an act that very directly involves the audience and asks the audience very gently to make a certain choice. I don't want to say a little bit more than that.
I was
going to
say, is this something you can tell us specifically about without giving the game
away? It's let's just say that the play asks the audience to make a choice.
The play asks white people to make a choice.
Right. The best way to help people understand is the play starts, the first half hour is what seems to be a very linear, straightforward play about African American middle class life,
preparing for a birthday dinner,
and it completely transforms several times. The first time it transforms, and I think we can tell them that they repeat the scene in silence with a voiceover of white people first commenting on their own ideas about race, and slowly it starts to ridicule the African-American characters on the stage. It takes this shift. It's a very shocking shift.
It's a weird, it's like a Mystery Science
3000. And from there, it keeps turning on these ideas over and over until it becomes a direct confrontation with the white audience members, who usually number the majority in the audience, and asks of them to make a decision that really forces them to reflect on what's going on. I think we can say that without giving away what happens.
And the night I saw it, after that decision had to be made by the white audience members, some of whom did what was asked and others did not, a black woman in the audience was really angry and piped up from her seat, addressing one of the black cast members, and he got really, really, really tense. Do you count that as disruption? Yes, but it was a very healthy one.
The disruption's built into the show. And
right.
I think we're using disruption too broadly, and I think protest disruption where you don't expect it versus disruption that you
this
built
is within
into
the context team. Of what the play is.
Although, from what I hear, I've talked to the publicist and other people who went to different performances, that was the most hostile one that the show got. And the actor had to really think on her feet to deal with it, because she dealt with it in character and it was not easy. And I have friends and colleagues who saw it at different nights and nothing like that happened again. So in that way, it was a disruption, because I'm not sure they planned for that. And I looked at the script and it really was, there was really no room for that. But it was also not disruptive in terms of that the audience member did not.
Okay, that's what you mean.
Ask,
okay.
No. Yeah.
Got you it. Know, got did it. Not yeah. ask. But she talked back directly.
Yes, exactly. Yes. She talked back to the.
Well. Wow. Theater. And, but the magic right. of live
it
theater.
Sounds, it sounds it was, thrilling,
it,
to be honest.
It was fantastic.
Is. And the other interesting thing we should just say is that there are white actors involved in the production, and
yes.
the and appropriation becomes part of this
yes.
process, too.
Yeah.
So,
yes.
so there's lots of stuff going on that really are, you know, covers a lot of the currents of what we're talking about.
Okay,
well, that's
right.
That's a didactic play. Its purpose is to
correct.
Explain something to the audience.
Its purpose is to explain something to white audiences.
Right,
because
right.
as a person of color who thinks about these issues all the time, it wasn't... I love the play, but it wasn't illuminating to me.
Right.
But it was still a very satisfying play.
But it's right, also, I think,
it's theatrically
satisfying.
Interesting.
It's
yeah,
also satisfying
exactly.
on a formal... From a formal perspective... With the shifting of the perspective constantly, I thought was formally very, very well done.
Okay,
from
well, let's come back to St. Louis for a moment. No, seriously. We should be here, but there's a reason why I want to make this transition. This is a play that was performed in New York, presumably in front of an audience of people who, at the very least, are well-meaning on this issue,
mm-hmm.
Done by performers who are... presumably fairly enlightened about it. I was thinking about the situation in St. Louis. It is a Midwestern city. The Muni is a company that does musicals. That is its audience. And I asked myself, since I, who am from New York, I had only the vaguest idea of what was going on while it was happening. And I found out afterwards that the protesters had not made any prior attempt to talk to the management of the Muni about the Yellow Face casting. And I thought to myself, okay, if you're doing this, why are you doing it? What do you want? And what's the best way to get it?
They told me what they want.
Well, I know what they want. They want yeah. the, but I mean, they want the situation to be changed.
No. They wanted attention to this issue because these things keep on happening, and it's happening in an 11,000 seat theater.
But the problem is, they didn't get it, because here we were in the theater. You saw a bunch of people standing up and yelling for about a minute.
But people talked about it afterwards. You're still talking about it. We're
yes,
talking about
here,
it in this room.
Here
people
in
are
New
talking
York.
About it in social media around the country about
but
it.
No
yes, but
coverage,
the people in the audience,
but,
are they
but
aware
no coverage,
of that?
So far I mean, as I know of, in the St. Louis newspapers.
There's been like 3 articles written in the St. Louis newspapers about it, Terry.
You mean in the Post-Dispatch?
In the local. Yeah, the local newspapers have written about it.
They caught up with it because they didn't for the
yeah.
first few days.
No. It's like Jeremy Goodwin's article came out the day right after.
That's not a newspaper. That was an on. That's the
but it's still coverage.
No, but look, I'm talking about how do the people who were in the house, the ordinary people, who I suspect okay. most of whom have never heard the word Yellow Face. How do you communicate with them? What's your goal?
I don't care. I do not. I don't fucking care about those people.
Okay.
Because it was that audience. It was like. So me, as a person of color sitting in that audience, it was like fucking sitting in Get Out.
Mm-hmm.
It was a shit ton of white people. Like, a shit ton.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry,
oh, wait,
Kirby, you're going to have to.
White people.
White people. So, that audience was like 75% white.
At least.
And the thing is, like, there are all these people of color who have protested and... have protested these shows, and somehow they didn't think, hey, maybe we should really be sensitive about what we're putting on these stages, especially if we want to diversify our audiences, considering that if you make a show more diverse, you get more money?
I think the point here is the difference is that message was directed at the Muni officials and the director of this and the people who chose
mm-hmm.
the cast. The audience will follow wherever you lead them. If
yeah.
you had they would not have cared. This audience, which doesn't care,
yeah.
essentially, about whether or not there's a Tuptim. Many of them don't care if there's a Tuptim who's Asian or not, because
no.
they're just not sensitized to
no.
the issue.
It's never occurred to them.
Yeah.
Whatever. I think the point being that I think the effectiveness and the difference here from the other example that Terry gave, which was the protest at Julius Caesar, was that these people wanted change from the people at this theater as a way of spreading to other theaters the message that this needs to be addressed.
Yes.
This needs to be addressed.
Why is this message not getting out? Because we talk about it a lot here in New York. People, I would venture to say that in New York, at least, it's taken for granted now that you don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it not taken for granted in St. Louis?
I think one of the reasons we hear a lot is that, well, we have a limited pool of actors. That's what I'm hearing when I, you know, we have a limited pool of actors on site. I'm not saying that's right. I'm saying that's what comes up, you know, regularly. Well, we have to triple cast the show. This actress was being tipped in as to play like five other roles.
Yeah,
and
that doesn't wash with this
show. I'm just saying right. That's what
not
we often hear.
All.
And also, you know, I heard 3 years ago from artistic directors that there were a dearth of plays by women because there's no plays in the pipeline. 3 years later, every good goddamn play in New York is by a woman. So we know that these things are, you know, these are just because they're lazy most of the time, the
inertia.
People who are making these
right.
decisions.
Inertia.
They make the easy yeah. choice as opposed to the right choice.
Well, I think it's a negotiable thing to not to. They think race versus verisimilitude is a negotiable thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not.
Got it. Well, that's a good way to end this discussion. This is a subject we've got to come back to. I hope that people out there who are listening to this podcast will add their own voices to it, help us sort through this. I can only thank Deep for joining Terry and Elizabeth and me on this occasion to make this discussion more illuminating. Well, this is a subject that deserves a lot more time than we can give it here. In the meantime, on to Lily.
Our special guest is Lily Janik. She was appointed the San Francisco Chronicle's theater critic in May 2016. And amazingly, she's still there.
Yeah.
I haven't brought it down yet, guys.
Before that, Lily wrote for Theater Bay Area, San Francisco Weekly, The Village Voice, and our host organization, American Theater. She has a BA in theater studies from Yale and a master's in drama from San Francisco State University.
Welcome, Lily, to Three on the Isle. You are speaking to us from the San Francisco Chronicle offices on the other coast. So tell us, what on earth made a presumably sane person like you want to become a drama critic? What dropped the coin?
Join this growth industry.
Yeah, really.
Well, I just love this art form. I do, but I should not be an artist, you guys. I really shouldn't. And it's not just that I'm a bad artist. It's not only that. It's also other things. I have to work by myself. I structure my whole life so that I can count on other people as little as possible, which is not really a good quality in a theater artist.
No kidding. That's what I learned when I started working in theater, was that there were other people in the room for the first time in my life.
I am just a lone wolf to the core. Mm. I love the form of the essay. I love wrangling my impressions into an argument and trying to come up with some coherent thing to say that necessarily is not going to be able to say everything, but hopefully still say something worthwhile and surprising and artful, and maybe articulates something that I and hopefully others had simmering in my subconscious somewhere, but just hadn't fully put into words yet. I love.
What was your
being
first?
Able to
oh, go on.
Pardon?
What was your? What I was about to ask. What was your first exposure to theater? When did it come in your life?
I saw community theater productions of Annie in Oklahoma with my grandma.
Was that instantaneous? Did you look at this and say, "This is cool. I want more of this"?
I don't know if it was theater instantly for me as a very 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 young child, but I had perfect pitch and I could pick up things on the piano. I was doomed to be the weird arts kid in a family of pathological athletes. It was just my fate was sealed early there. I think I really, really decided that theater is magic and special And unlike any other art form, when I was in high school and discovered the plays of Tennessee Williams and Sam Shepard, I felt that in theater, people can say things that they can't say in real life because of some power that being on the stage gives them.
So Lily, what's your beat? What are the, give us a sense for people, listeners in other parts of the country, what are the what's the meat and potatoes of what you cover? Where do you go to find the stuff that you love to write about
in, and how in often the, in do the you Bay write Area? Also?
Oh, well, this week's an especially busy week. It's a 7 review in 9 days kind of week.
Wow.
For me.
Yikes.
I try to keep it closer to 3 per week. Just because I find that after the 3rd show, I start to get a little less excited about going to the theater. What's y'all, do you guys have like a threshold like that where you?
Yeah, yes, definitely.
Yes, it's called April. the end of the Tony season.
There you go.
But isn't it amazing though when you see like 4 or 5 just so shows and you start thinking, why am I doing this again?
Right.
And suddenly you see one
right.
That just like, it just fills up the tank again and you are ready to just go for another round.
Yeah. Yeah. Four is maximum, but I have weeks where I see 7 like you. I mean, and
sure.
I just find that it can become oppressive when you're just assembly lining them out.
Yeah, except in April, I try to keep it to 1 or 2 a week when I can.
There can be too much theater. It's a thing.
So yes, what are the big theaters that you cover so people know out there?
Our flagship institutions are American Conservatory Theater, which also has a major MFA program right up there with Yale
right.
Rep and NYU. Berkeley Rep, Cal Shakes, Marin Theater Company, Theater Works, Aurora Theater, and then maybe... If I'm going down to tier 2, well, maybe Magic Theater is actually up there. I mean, the list goes on. San Francisco Playhouse, Shotgun Players.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it's an extremely active scene.
Oh boy. My predecessor, Robert Hurwitt, used to say that when there were 2.5 people on this beat, you could sort of cover the whole scene.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And over his tenure, he saw that shrink to 1 person on the beat. And that is what I have inherited. So mm-hmm. It is far, far too much for me to do it justice. But I am energized to always keep trying.
Do you assign yourself?
It's a conversation between my editors and me. There are some productions that are inherently newsworthy that they and I both know I have to cover, but I can fight to cover pretty much anything I want, but there are a limited number of battles I can pick each month.
I'm just curious, like when you write a review, do you have who do you write the review for? Do you have a reader in mind? Like, do you write it for like the audience member? Do you write it for... Do you assume the creative team is going to read it? I mean, for me, it's really all part of the conversation. But do you think of that at all? Do you just write it for yourself in a way?
I'm writing for a very general readership because I'm always hoping to bring more folks into the mm-hmm. theatrical fold. And I guess I assume a certain baseline education, but I hope that people read my reviews even if they have no huge interest in theater, just for the pleasure of reading a well-written essay.
Yes.
Lily, you and I have similar jobs. I think I'm at the Washington Post. You're at the San Francisco Chronicle. We really are considered, I think, major voices in criticism in those cities. And I wonder, do you feel the way I do sometimes that do you feel... Without being a cheerleader, that you are an advocate for the creative quality of what comes out of the best stuff that comes out of your region?
I am advocating even when I am criticizing. And I firmly believe this, that in order to have a robust theater scene, a robust art form, and robust arts journalism, I have to be honest, but that to write about a show's flaws mm-hmm. in a way that shows that it's important to talk about
right.
these mm-hmm. failures or the ways this show didn't live up to perhaps what it set out to do, that is also advocating for the scene.
And that's a hard thing to do because I don't think everyone understands the function, especially when you've got a community. I have found, interestingly, when I reviewed for the New York Times, that more people in New York would write to me angrily when I liked something that they didn't. And in Washington, I get much more angry mail when I don't like something because they're more protective of the form of the audience. I can't generalize to a large degree about that. Obviously, there are degradations. But do you find that as well, that there's a interesting balance you have to strike as a person in this perch?
Oh, it is a million balances all mm-hmm. the time. And you're inevitably going to step too far sometimes. But the nice thing about working for a daily paper is if you're not satisfied with how one piece turned out, you're going to get another chance in 12 hours or so.
Yeah, that's great.
Boy,
exactly
is that true.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Tell us about San Francisco as a center of theater. I review all over the country, and I've found that some cities really do have there's a distinctive stylistic quality to what's going on there. Chicago is very much its own theater center in terms of what they do. Is there a characteristic feel to San Francisco theater, something you can describe to us?
When we were talking about doing this podcast, I was worried about this question because I'm such a provincial girl. Mm. I have seen so not much theater elsewhere, and our travel budget is basically nil. So I don't really have a huge sense of comparison. I don't go see theater in Chicago or New York or London all the time or ever.
Well, most people don't, Lily. I mean,
I don't. Right.
My situation is very unusual that way.
I suppose this isn't something I necessarily believe, but it's kind of the scuttlebutt or maybe like a reductive thesis that I'm kind of always testing in my head each time I see a new show, which is that New York theater is more artistic and SF theater is more political. And
oh, that's interesting.
By political, I don't necessarily mean every show is like the work of the San Francisco Mime Troupe. Mm-hmm. But I guess I mean there's kind of a pressure to adhere to a certain righteous, lefty, progressive politics out here.
Oh, we don't have that here in New York, Lily.
Well, right. but I wonder, that's why I'm always testing the thesis when I read y'all's reviews, for example. So that's maybe the one thought that's kind of percolating in my brain.
Mm-hmm. Have you noticed an evolution in the past few years in San Francisco? San Francisco and the area are very wealthy. We hear that the rents are even higher than ours, which is saying something. Have you noticed a change in the way the wealth of Silicon Valley has? I mean, are there, for instance, donors? Are there people? Is there philanthropy interested in supporting theater?
Boy.
Or are they not into that at all? Is it completely like you guys are left on your own and the wealth is not trickling to the arts at all?
Such a great question. I would say it is the central problem of most of our regional nonprofit theaters. How do we get tech to be interested in us? Hmm. I was talking to Carrie Perloff about this, she's the artistic director of ACT out here, and this was not on the occasion of her stepping down, which is happening at this July, but celebrating ACT's 50th. And she was saying that tech donors like to solve problems. And art, we're not the solution. We are the problem.
I'm stealing that.
That's Terry Latham.
Yeah, please do. It's really good. It's we're a difficult field to quantify. Like, how do you put into numbers how art works?
Right.
You can't really. There have been some efforts to do that, but without those, I don't know, before and after graphs, it can be really hard to tempt the techies who are so used to thinking in terms of what's quantifiable.
And probably don't go to theater anyway. I mean, it's a whole different world for them.
Well, you know, these guys get to work at 10 and then their dinner's provided for them at their office. They're incentivized to keep staying late at work. You know, it's really an all consuming thing. So
interesting.
The techie who leads the balanced life is the rare one.
So which leads to a question. I'm going to see very soon Ain't Too Proud, this musical based on the Temptations that was at Berkeley Rep that you saw not too long ago.
And I'm about to see Head Over Heels.
And right. So, you know, it is a place where people want to try out shows that eventually make their way to us. But Lily, are there things that you find that play other places that don't play in San Francisco well? I mean, is there a discernible, or are we such a homogenous society now in that sense that things like Hamilton and, you know, obviously other things that are smash hits everywhere are natural sort of fits for San Francisco too, just because that exists, that culture is that generalized.
I do wonder about the homogeneity I see in the regional theater movement across the country. You know, that sense you get when you look at a theater season in Oregon and Texas and Colorado, and they're kind of all the same set of plays.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I try not to measure San Francisco's success as a theater town just by what it ships to you guys.
Right.
But what is that other metric of success? Just
is there a
really good art, a great review from me? I mean,
well, is there a San Francisco School of Writers? I mean, is there a Bay Area group of people who write for theaters in the Bay Area?
Well, I mean, when you say San Francisco writers, an interesting dichotomy I always go back to is we are the town of both Lauren Gunderson and Christopher Chen.
Very good distinction. Yeah.
Yeah. And to think about how different those two writers are, and both of them, theaters are out here are dying to work with Lauren's fizzy, hilarious, fast moving comedies and feminist histories of science, but they're also dying to take on Chris's like crazy I don't even know how to describe always. I was trying to create a hashtag for a while, the Chen mindfuck. That took off, but maybe now that you guys know it, it'll just spread like wild.
We're working on it. We'll
mentioning them makes me want to ask you, how much contact, day-to-day contact, do you have with the theater community in San Francisco? How close are you to people? How well do you know people? Do you feel the need to be distanced from them? Have you gotten stiffed on the aisle before? Tell us about that.
Oh, well, Chris is actually a good example, and I hope he won't mind my sharing this, but I even forget how we became buds, but we used to go to shows together when I had a less high profile gig at the SF Weekly and writing for HowlRound, and we would get drinks. And I guess we both kind of came to the realization after I got this job at the Chronicle that we really shouldn't go to plays with each other anymore.
right.
Unfortunately, we're not quite as close of friends as a result.
Yeah. Does the journal or does the Chronicle have a worked out conflict policy that applies to you?
I mean, we have, I think, what would be a pretty standard policy about sources and relationships with sources. So I mostly just try to follow my own internal compass, but yeah, I miss my regular drinks with Chris for sure. But
of course,
this isn't a job you take if you need to have a million friends in the theater. That's just not what being a critic is all about. Mm. You can't expect that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. What about, you know, I'm looking, we can see Lily.
Right.
We're on Skype here. You guys can't see Lily. And of course, one of the things that strikes me is that she's probably 40 years younger than I am or so. No, not that much. But much younger than I am.
Half a century younger than us.
Which is really gratifying as a writer who thinks, you know, what's going to come after me. Do you, are you seeing yet, Lily, audiences responding? Do you think that the voices of criticism need to be younger? Are we at a point where we need people? Do you speak more clearly to a generation that I can't reach? Do you think?
I mean, my answer is no assault on Peter Marx in any way whatsoever.
That's all right.
We'll
assault.
Take care of that.
Go away.
Great. Thanks, guys. But I think the industry needs to be more diverse in every way, mm-hmm. in every pocket, not just
right.
by age, but by every demographic factor you can think of. We have a huge artistic director changeover happening here mm-hmm. in the Bay right. Area. And
nationally,
I'm really too. Excited about the possibility that some of these theaters, that's ACT, Berkeley Rep, Theater Works, The
wow.
Aurora, Cal Shakes was a couple of years
wow.
ago, Cunning Ball just named a new artistic director. And I'm really excited about theirs because she's under 30 years old. Her name's Ariel Kraft. And I'm just, I don't know. I think boards and theater companies need to take a chance on some younger new leaders. It can be a yeah. risk,
right.
but I don't know. There's an energy and a restlessness and a connectedness, a hunger that young artists and leaders have that mm-hmm. I'm not saying that every post needs to be filled that way, but I just want to see what the new generation has mm-hmm. to say
mm-hmm.
and how they'll restructure what regional theater is, how they'll change up the subscription model, maybe.
The subscription, oh my God, we should do a whole podcast about yeah. the subscription really model.
Should.
Because
yeah. Well, that leads me to wonder, Lily, is the job what you'd hoped it would be? How are you feeling about it at this stage?
This is the best job in the world.
I feel the same way. Yeah. The dream job.
I think of it like I think of my bicycle. I have had many bicycles stolen, and I've come to realize that my bicycle is on loan from the universe, and eventually the universe will take it back. And I try to have the same Zen approach to my job. I have this wonderful, wonderful gift that is being an arts critic full time at a daily paper. I hope it can last forever. I wish there were like a kryptonite U-lock I could have for my job.
Do you, okay, what?
That's a great line.
Do you ride your bike to shows? And
if yes,
okay, yep. What's the farthest you've ridden your bike for a show?
Well, we were talking about this before we went on air, but just this past week, I rode 850 miles to Blue Lake, California, up near the Oregon border to Del Arte International in Blue Lake, where I saw Rosante Comes Home from the War, a Commedia dell'arte piece that was staged outside, basically in the middle of the woods. So
wait, so was that 800 miles like round trip or one way?
Yeah, starting at Davis, California, up to near the border, and then down the coast to near Santa Rosa, California.
Wow. Oh my God.
Not the most direct route. I'm sure you'll be shocked to know we did not bicycle on the interstate.
I once walked from a bus station to Signature Theater, so I feel very close to you.
Yeah.
It was three blocks. That's really good.
You are a woman of great dedication and also a very fun person to talk to.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you, Lily. Lily Janik. We've got to have Lily Janik back on.
No kidding.
Oh, yes.
Lily.
I mean, I think so.
Yeah.
We're sold, but don't go anywhere.
We need you to report back to us from time to time. Will you be our West Coast correspondent, maybe?
Sure.
Oh, good. So stick around for a few more minutes because we're going to segue into our final phase here, our traditional final segment in which we talk briefly about a piece of theater we've seen lately that we've really enjoyed or wanted to rail about. As the guest of honor, Ms. Janik, will you go first and tell us about something you've seen?
Well, you caught me on the perfect day because I just gave a rave review to Soft Power, the new Janine.
Wow.
Yeah, the new Janine Tesori and David Henry Hwang. It's called A Play with a Musical.
Right.
Okay. So that's kind of like a musical within a play. And it is so smart and sly and fun.
Wow.
And it has all of the things we musical theater lovers love. The Fred and Ginger dance scenes. But it uses them in a very subversive way. Mm. It envisions a future in which China has cultural influence in addition to military and economic might.
Mm.
And so the Chinese are writing a musical and they get a lot of things wrong, just as, say, Hollywood folks do when they take on other cultures. So, as an example, a character lands in Hollywood Airport and sees the Statue of Liberty right there. It's a thing called reverse Orientalism, which is a new term for me.
Wow.
But anyways, it's hilarious and it skewers musical theater, but it also uses musical theater in a traditional way as well. It is not a show without heart. I can't wait to hear what you guys think about it. I'm sure it will be on the East Coast soon.
I'd bet on that, too.
You've sold me.
Yeah.
You've sold me, Lily. Terry, are you going to tell us about something?
Something that I liked very much and just saw. There's a company here in New York called the Mint Theater Company, an off-Broadway troupe that specializes in forgotten plays. They've been around for 15 seasons, I don't know how long, but they have a perfect track record. I reviewed them 13 times. Every show has been remarkable. And they pulled another one out of the hat this time with a play called Conflict by a man named Miles Mallison, who is, you've probably seen him and don't know him, because he was one of those character actors with a funny face that turned up all the time and movies by Hitchcock. He plays the Chasuble in The Importance of Being Earnest. But he had a serious career as a playwright in the 20s and early 30s. And the Mint has exhumed a play of his, a very political play, about two college friends who were running against each other for the House of Commons, one a socialist, the other a hidebound conservative. But he's written, although Mallison was himself a socialist, very politically active, he has written the play with the tone of a drawing room comedy, with very high drama, fabulously well made, one of those plays where all the bombs go off in the last 5 minutes. And as always with the Mint, it is a marvelous piece of theater and a real rediscovery. I raved about it in the issue of the journal that's appearing on the day that we're taping this podcast.
Oh,
and I hope they sell out. I hope they sell a lot of tickets.
I hope they do too. Are we an all rave panel, Elizabeth? What are you going to talk about?
The play that I like the most recently, we just talked about. It's the Jackie Sibley's Drury play Fairview at Soho Rep. But I just saw a play that I want to mention because I despised it in a way that I have not despised a play in a long time, to the point that I could not bring myself to clap at the end. And I always clap, even if I don't like the show, because I feel like I need to do that for the actors.
You couldn't.
Right? And I could not bring myself to do anything that would be seen as endorsing this piece of garbage.
That what is was called, the show?
It is called Cypress Avenue. It is at the Public, and it's brought over by the Royal Court in London and the Abbey Theatre in Dublin. So it's got a prestigious pedigree. It is utter exploitation. you remember the snuff, the legend of the snuff movie? It's a snuff play. It is sub-Tarantino-esque exploitation, trying to pass as subversive. It is vile. And it has a wonderful cast.
Vincent Kelly.
Led by the wonderful character actor Stephen Ray.
Oh, God.
Don't be Neil I mean, he's just wonderful. Yeah. But it is a fraudulent, intellectually dishonest play that ends in unbelievable violence that is never earned. Cypress Avenue, I absolutely... Yeah, it is garbage.
Well, allow me to quote the British musicologist Hans Keller, who said, "When I hate something, I ask myself why I like it."
I'm going to think about that show a lot, because it exemplifies a lot of what is wrong with when a playwright tries to be "quote unquote" edgy and subversive,
right?
And doing it in a way that does not work at all, because the premise is fraudulent.
Well, I'm almost sheepish now because I
don't tell me I'm you loved it.
No. But I'm gonna segue now to a production I saw in Washington. I was so stunned at how much I liked it. It was a revival of Camelot.
Okay. Oh my goodness.
I know. I'm sorry, everybody. It really showed for me that, you know, an old musical is old and dated until someone shows you that it's not.
Exactly.
Yes,
exactly.
That's so right.
And and this one did that for me, directed by Alan Paul out of all places, the Shakespeare Theater Company. It's a play not just about this thwarted love between Arthur and Guinevere, but it's really about democracy and the idea of a mind that creates an idea of a generous spirit that thinks about everything except his own needs in a monarchic situation. So I hope, and I have a feeling that this piece might have legs. It might bring this musical back. It's done very streamlined and in a very modest way.
And we haven't seen a Camelot in a while.
It's a show.
I saw a small scale Camelot at Two River in New Jersey that had the same effect on me. I don't like Camelot, or I thought I didn't, and suddenly here I am, completely wrapped up in a musical I don't think I like.
Right. It strains to be lighthearted, and it feels a little bit like that doesn't really work. Round peg and square hole sometimes, but the music is lush, and this production really worked.
I felt the same way about My Fair Lady, actually. I never really cared for it. And when I saw the recent revival, I was completely just with it, 100%.
Mm. Yep. So there you have it, guys. A wrap on the 15th episode. Want to thank, first of all, Lily Janik for her great contribution.
Our new West Coast correspondent.
Our new West Coast correspondent, exactly. We'll explain all the details of that. There are lots of responsibilities.
And
Lily.
The handshake.
And a really big salary.
Oh, yes.
That goes without saying.
And possibly a bike.
Yeah, exactly. She doesn't need that.
Or at least a chain. Gets stolen.
Yeah, exactly. Good point. So with that, I'm Peter Marks of The Washington Post.
I'm Terry Teachout. And you've been listening to Three on the Isle, a twice-monthly podcast from New York about theater in America, hosted by American Theater Magazine.
I'm Elizabeth Vincentelli. Our producer is Kirby Pate. You can follow us on Twitter at Three on the Isle and write to us at threeontheisle@gmail.com.
And please give us your thoughts on the topics we've raised and what you'd like to hear on future podcasts. And leave a rating, 5 stars, please, and a review on iTunes or Google Play. Especially if you've liked what you've heard.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you again next time on The Isle.